Yeah, I think so.
Button on, off.
I think it's off already. I think he was muting it up there. Yeah, it's off. They're very clever. Idiot proof.
That's surprising. Oh, the clicker is here. Jonathan? The clicker is here. Okay, good evening, everyone. Nonek, as program director, I would like to welcome all of you at the second public seminar of the summer school, session 2. And it's with great pleasure that I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Jonathan Leap. Dr. Jonathan Leap is an associate professor in the economics department and is executive director of the International Growth Center. He was also the founding director of the LSE Center for Research into Economics and Finance in Southern Africa, and has advised governments in Africa. His research centers on public economics with a focus on taxation and regulation. In fact, Dr. Jonathan Leap has taught for many years the popular course Public Finance in the summer school at LSE. I think it was even more than 15 years, and it's great to have him back, for this occasion. Tonight, Dr. Jonathan Leap will talk about new approaches to growth in developing countries. After his talk, that will take about 45 minutes, we have time for some questions, and we'll close the evening with a reception in the senior common room, on the fifth floor here, to which you are all invited. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jonathan Leap.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Marcia. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful to you for giving up sort of afternoon in the park to be here instead. What I want to talk about today is new approaches to growth at several different levels, and you'll see, I think, what I mean as I go along. So I want to talk about what's created the opportunity for new thinking and new approaches to growth on the policy level, as well as new approaches in terms of new ideas generated by research. I think if we want to think seriously about new approaches to growth, it's a natural starting point is to start with countries that have had really outstanding growth trajectories. And I want to do that with just two examples. So this is a photo from Purnia, which is the fourth largest city in the state of Bihar in India. Bihar is the poorest state in India. Between 2005 and 2012, it achieved very rapid rates of growth, double-digit growth for something like whatever that was, 7-8 years running, as a result of very strong leadership, a chief minister, Nitish Kumar. And if you look at their growth experiences, two things stand out. One is that this rapid growth had a dramatic impact on poverty. So the poverty rate in Bihar at the beginning of that period was 54%, and by the end it was 33%. So it was a sharp drop in poverty as a result of the sustained high rates of growth. The other thing that jumps out from the example is that there was no single magic solution. There was no one big policy that drove their high growth experience. Instead, there were lots and lots and lots of little policies. So there were a series of changes to strengthen law and order, and then other changes aimed at improving governance. There were a series of reforms in education and in health, but also large-scale infrastructure projects. 55,000 kilometers of new road was constructed, and more than 14,000 bridges. There were initiatives to increase poverty and productivity in agriculture and reforms to empower women. So while on the one hand the Bihar example shows how growth can be inclusive, reducing poverty, and transformational, it also tells us that how to achieve high rates of growth is a big question that doesn't have a big answer. It's a big question that seems to have lots and lots of little answers. I want to just talk for a second now about a second example. This is a market in Ethiopia. We had the IGC, International Growth Center, had its Africa Growth Forum in Addis Ababa in June, just over a year ago. And one of the people who spoke at the conference was Dr. Arkebe, who is a minister in the Office of the Prime Minister and really leads their growth strategy. And he's written a book published last year called Made in Africa, Industrial Policy in Ethiopia. And what he emphasized when he spoke was the crucial importance of what he called policy independence. And what he meant by that was that countries cannot achieve high rates of growth just by importing some formula, importing some solutions that have worked elsewhere. That actually the only way to achieve high rates of growth is through the hard slog of looking at the local context and examining the impact of diverse initiatives and constructing a homegrown growth policy, which is informed by rigorous research. So I think what came out very much from that experience in Ethiopia, which continues, and Ethiopia is really, it continues to have very strong growth performance, is the need to bring research and policy together. I think now if we zoom out from the country level to a sort of 35,000 feet level, we see that there have been some quite powerful dynamics at work globally that have also changed the environment for growth policy and made it possible to achieve much more integration and use of research in policy formation than has previously been possible. So what's changed? Well, on the one hand, policymaking has changed. We've seen, of course, democratization. Many more countries, developing countries now, have democratic systems that have had successful transitions from a first elected leader to a second. And part of that has been associated the accountability, the increased accountability that has been associated with that democratization has also seems to have induced a much broader use of evidence in policymaking. So the political changes, and particularly the increased accountability associated with more democratic systems, seems to have driven an increase in use of evidence as well. So one big global factor is that the environment for policymaking has changed really quite significantly. A second is that economics, and I think more broadly the social sciences, have changed. What I'm thinking of particularly, and it's most striking in economics, but you see it across many of the other social sciences, is what's sometimes referred to as the credibility revolution over the past two decades. And that's really been the recognition within economics that started in the sort of early 90s, that a lot of our empirical methods really weren't very robust. So they might have been very, very technical, they might have been very, very complicated, but they didn't actually robustly identify causal relationships. And in particular, in this context, causal relationships between policy instruments and desirable economic outcomes. So we ended up having lots and lots of regression analysis with some very sophisticated examples, but that turned out not to be very robust and hence turned out not to be a very good guide for policy. And what happened as a result was a kind of back to the basics within empirical research, which said we really need to think about how it is that we can demonstrate causality in using empirical data. And of course, that really ultimately means going back to the scientific method of saying, okay, well, we need to think what the counterfactual is of what might have happened. So in a policy instance, you know, do we have two situations we can compare? One where we had a change of some sort, change in the tax rate, introduction of a new program, whatever it might be, and another, which is the control, where there wasn't that change, so that we can compare these two groups and get some sense of the impact of the change itself, as opposed to something else that might have been going on at the same time. Well, why is that kind of, you know, controlled experimental approach, which can be a real experiment or it can be a sort of natural experiment. Why is that so important? Well, because typically when some aspect of policy changes, lots of other stuff is changing at the same time. So a sort of traditional approach of trying to determine the effect of a policy by looking at the before and the after has the very big problem that lots of other things might have changed between that before and after, not just the policy change that you're interested in, but there could have been changes in the economic cycle, there could have been changes in the trade environment, there could have been changes in trend, changes in education or health or other things that might affect your the instruments that you're interested in. So what we need to do is find some way of establishing an effective control that then enables us to understand better what the impact is of the policy change or the policy instrument. And in part, that's led to this explosion of randomized control trials, as you probably know. And I'm going to be talking about some research later on, which uses randomized control trials. But it's also just more generally led to much clearer thinking about causality and how we can determine causality. And that, of course, is hugely important if we want to inform policy and if we want to advise policy makers. We need to have a reasonable degree of confidence that what we're suggesting is based on a robust causal relationship that we've managed to establish with empirical data. Well, the third thing, which isn't quite so global as the first two, but I think is important and certainly is very, very close to the heart of what the IGC is about, is the emergence of new ways of working with policymakers. And the term that we use is the term of co-generation. This comes a bit from the example that you may have heard of community policing. So one of the innovations over the past, four decades in policing has been an increased use of what's called community policing. And community policing is described in the sort of academic literature as the co-production of security. Because community policing is about getting the community on side and having police work very closely with the community. And so the idea, it's no longer the policewoman or the policeman that's providing this security. It's this cooperation or collaboration between the community and the policeman that is generating it. And similarly, our model is one where we make it possible. We have 15 country offices. We have 5 country offices in Asia, South Asia, and 10 across Africa. And through that and the relationships those offices have with senior policymakers, we make it possible for researchers to work directly with policymakers right from the beginning of their research, not just when they have something ready to hand over that they think should influence research. And the idea there is to recognize that policymakers are not just decision makers and not just implementers, but they're actually also knowledge generators themselves. They can have quite sophisticated understanding of the local context, whether that's political or social or cultural or economic. And so that if we can create a situation in which there is at least a degree of co-generation of knowledge, that is the researcher bringing her understanding of the scientific frontier. So what is it that we don't know as scholars, and what is it that we know? And the policymaker bringing his or her understanding of the political, social, cultural context. And by bringing the two together to then generate, to co-generate research in a new way, with the aim, of course, of being much more relevant to the situation the policymaker finds herself in. So those are things that I think have changed really at the sort of high level, at the global level. If you remember just one thing from this lecture, remember this graph. So what does this show us? This graph shows us total factor productivity on the vertical axis and per capita GDP income on the horizontal axis. And these are sort of log scales. And what you see is a very, very strong relationship between growth and prosperity, between growth and per capita, between productivity and prosperity, between productivity and per capita incomes. And that's really, in a sense, a final sort of factor that has driven these new approaches to growth, and that is just recognizing that growth is all about productivity and increases in productivity. That rising incomes are only going to be generated in a sustainable way if countries succeed in increasing productivity over time. And what we're talking about here is total factor productivity. So that's in excess of any increases in inputs, whether that's labor or capital or other inputs. Is the economy able to generate more with less, or generate more from the same inputs? And so this is the key challenge of growth, is how to increase productivity. And if we look at developing countries in particular, there are two important dynamics involved with increasing productivity. If you were to look at a graph which showed you the productivity of individuals across a population, then what would look very different about a developing country from a developed country is the large fraction of the population that are stuck in low productivity activities. So, and that's another way of saying they have a lot of people in poverty. So low-income developing countries have a huge number of people that are stuck in low productivity activities like subsistence agriculture, like street trading, like agricultural labor. All of those are occupations that have very low levels of productivity, and people are consequently really trapped in low incomes. So one of the key growth challenges for developing countries is shifting people out of low productivity activities into higher productivity activities. So in a sense, that part of the challenge of growth is the challenge of occupational change. How do we get people out of these very low productivity activities and into more productive activities? The second dynamic that's important in developing countries, but is important in all countries, is that of increasing the productivity of firms and households across the economy. And a big part of that is making sure that resources are being directed to those individuals, and particularly those firms that are most productive, and that those firms in particular that are least productive are exiting industries or dropping out of industries. So the second dynamic is generating a generally rising level of productivity across the economy, and I'll come back to this with some other examples later on. And typically, to do that by ensuring that the mechanisms that channel resources in the economy are channeling resources to the most productive firms and away from the least productive firms. Well, we focus on low-income countries, as I said, and really believe there are four key drivers of prosperity and of productivity growth over time in these low-income economies. The first is effective government. The second is productive firms, and they're, of course, in a sense, the center of everything. The third is reliable and sustainable energy and access to that for households and firms. And the last is functioning cities. So what I'd like to do now is zoom back down to a more micro level and give you examples across these four areas of some of the new ideas that are driving growth and in this context, in the developing country context. So in the case of effective government, or what we sometimes refer to as state effectiveness more generally, there's sort of two headings that sort of drive our research. One is politics and policy choice, and I want to give you an example in a minute about sort of relates really to accountability. And the other is what we call building state capabilities, and that's really the state's ability to deliver stuff, so to raise taxes and to deliver services and infrastructure and so forth. So I want to give you some examples under these different headings. In effect, it's recognizing that the state is an essential enabler of growth in all countries. And it is, of course, a critical part of the development process is that state capabilities are developed so that the economies can then develop. So let me start with an example from the sort of political economy side. In 1997, Easterly and Levin published a very influential article, which more or less argued that Africa was doomed because it had this ethnic fractionalization, and that deeply and profoundly undermined economic performance. So that's, of course, a hugely important thesis to understand, and understand whether there are ways that those effects might be mitigated. So what I want to do is just talk briefly about a research project which looked at this in the context of Kenya. and first said, can we really see what the impact is of ethnic favoritism? So that's an element of this problem where governments of a particular ethnic group then favor members of the population or who are co-ethnic, who are in that population group. And then we want to ask, so is there evidence that that happens, that there is a problem? And then if so, does the nature of the political system make a difference? Okay, so this is a graph. It's based on a paper by our colleague Robin Burgess here on road building in Kenya over the period 1960 to 2007 or something, 2010. This paper took a lot of work because they wanted to look at road building. So they had to figure out how are we going to sort of get measures of this. And what they did was to do two very sort of labor-intensive exercises. One was they got the Michelin maps for every year from 1960 to 2010, and they found out how many kilometers of road were built between the previous edition and the current edition. So they had a measure of how many kilometers were built of road and where across the country for the whole period of 50 years. The second thing they did was to go into the books of the Ministry of Finance and figure out how much money was spent on roads. Now, roads were an important thing to focus on because they were the single largest item of expenditure for the government for most of this period. So roads were a hugely important function of the government, and so a very nice way to test whether the allocation of roads or the building of roads was being distorted by ethnic favoritism. So this is a graph which shows you essentially where roads were built when. So it starts in 1960, and we see these two different curves. So the red line is roads that were built in, so what is this? Is this expenditure? Yeah, so this is the fraction of expenditure, of total expenditure on roads that was spent in non-co-ethnic districts. So President Kenyatta, Jomo Kenyatta, was the founding president when Kenya became democratic, became independent, was from the Kikuyu tribe. So the question is, how much of road spending went to other population groups, that's the red line, and how much spending went to the Kikuyu tribe, in his case, when he was president, which is the blue line. Now, the first period of his presidency was democracy. So immediately after independence, there was a period of democracy. And you can see, although things bounced around a bit, there was really no evidence that the Kikuyu areas of Kenya got any increased road spending. That the two, the red and the blue, sort of bounce around one, which is the line of no bias. But look what happens in 1970 when effectively Kenya became an autocracy. Between 1970 and 1978, while Kenyatta was still president, so it's the same person, but there's been a change in the nature of the of government. And what we see is spending on roads in co-ethnic areas takes off. So here, the two means that spending on road building in co-ethnic areas was twice that in the twice that as a fraction of population share. And you can see what happened correspondingly is that the non-Kikuyu groups got less than their share. Now, because Kikuyu is a fairly small minority, you don't see these groups dropping as much as you see this benefiting, the Kikuyu benefiting. But the really interesting thing is that presidents change, so Moi was elected in 78, and he was from a different tribe, from the Kalenjin tribe, but this was still an autocracy. And what we see is this pattern of ethnic favoritism continued, only this was no longer spending on Kikuyu areas, this was now spending on Kalenjin areas. So this blue means a different thing from that blue in terms of what areas were getting the roads, but they were both co-ethnic with the president, right? So spending here was on the Kikuyu areas and this was on the Kalenjin areas. And you can see that the distortion was even greater. That is, even more roads were being built in the co-ethnic areas as a fraction, you know, compared to their population share. And then in 93, there was a return of democracy in Kenya. And you can see that once that happened, the favoritism declined very sharply. And there was then a subsequent change in president. And again, although things bounced around, more or less, the sort of ethnic favoritism disappeared. So what comes out very clearly from this is that democracy is potentially quite powerful. in eliminating ethnic favoritism. They didn't sort of go into trying to determine what one of the factors might be most important, but they speculate that things like the increased freedom of the press and increased accountability through the legislature and those sorts of things all contributed to democracy generating a better and a more efficient result. Just one final thing about this paper which is worth noting is just to make it, strongly the link to growth, is they then looked also in the paper at whether these periods of democracy and autocracy looked any different in terms of growth experience. This is much less robust as a result than the previous graph I showed you because lots of other stuff was happening at the same time, both in the world and in Kenya, than just the change in government. Nevertheless, it's quite striking that the growth performance of Kenya declined very steadily and sharply during the period of autocracy, and that economic performance in general was stronger both before and afterwards, so in the initial period of democracy and then the subsequent period of democracy. So this, I wouldn't want to say is anything more than suggestive, but it's interesting that we see this strong growth correlation. Okay, well, what about the sort of nuts and bolts of government and what can be done there? Well, to begin with, one of the key things that distinguishes developing countries from developed countries is they have real problems raising tax. In fact, our colleague Tim Besley, in a very influential article with Torsten Pearson, argued that taxation, that the primary challenge of development is to raise tax revenue from 10 or 15% or less up to 30 to 40%. That's really what the challenge of development is all about. And you might think that, of course, tax revenue is important because it enables governments to provide services and to build infrastructure. And that's all true. But there's a more subtle thing that's important about tax revenue that Tim and Torsten really brought out in their paper, in that as tax systems become more effective and as tax rates become higher, they create a different set of incentives for government, because with a working tax system which is raising significant amounts of tax revenue, the government has an incentive to play a productive role in the economy as opposed to an extractive role. So when tax systems are weak, governments and particular politicians have an incentive to try to extract resources in one way or another, whether that's through mineral rents or whether that's through corruption on big state contracts, whatever it is. If the tax system is weak, then there's an incentive for politicians to try to extract resources from the state. Whereas the stronger the tax system, the more governments realize that they're able to deliver for their constituencies and maintain themselves in power by growing the economy, because they know that with an effective tax system, that growing the economy is going to strengthen tax revenues and their ability to deliver. So in addition to enabling you to just fund services and build infrastructure, tax system turns out to be quite important because, in effect, it makes the government a shareholder in the economy, right? That the tax rate is your share of output in the economy. And if governments then behave more like shareholders as opposed to like predators, then we get better outcomes. Well, okay, fine to say we want to increase tax, but how do we do it? So let me just give you one example, which is research that has been done in Pakistan, which happens to be a very nice example of co-generation, that process I told you about before. So these are three economists. One's a colleague of mine here, Adnan Khan. One is a professor at MIT, Ben Olkin, one's a professor at the Kennedy School, Harvard Kennedy School, Asim Khacha. And the three of them have worked with the Punjab Tax Department in Pakistan. And they've been working now together for 7 years. And a government agreed to do an experiment involving all of their tax inspectors. So Punjab province is big. I forget, it's between 200 and 300 million people, or 200 and 250 million people. So it's a big province. They agreed to involve all of their tax inspectors, tax collectors, in an experimental scheme to try to figure out if there's anything they could do to raise revenues. So what did they do? Well, they said, okay, well, let's allocate some of these tax inspectors to a control group so they won't have any bonus, and then let's use this as an opportunity to learn about whether different bonus systems might have different effects. So the first of them was you get an incentive based on only revenue collected. And this was what we call a high-powered incentive in the sense that the money at stake was large. The tax inspectors could more than double their incomes if they had a significant increase in performance over the previous year. So the bonus was based on your performance this year compared to last year. And if it increased enough, you could more than double your salary. There were some concerns that actually that could lead to extortion and other sort of bad behavior by the inspector because it's such a strong incentive. So the second scheme involved customer feedback, and the tax inspector was told that her bonus would be based on customer feedback as well as revenue. And then the third was a more typical bonus scheme, which said, there's lots of things we want you to do as a tax inspector, raise revenue, satisfy your customers, do the paperwork, whatever. And so it was a sort of multi-sort of point bonus system. So those are the three schemes they ran. Here's the impact on revenues. So I think the most striking thing is just how big the impact was. So the pure financial bonus, that is the where you got a fraction of the revenue raised, increased tax revenue by more than 10%, so by about 11% in 2012, and then just over 12% in 2013. So a big effect on revenues. The other incentive schemes, as you might guess, had less of an effect, not as significant. So 3 stars means that this was highly significant, these estimates. Not as significant in the case of these schemes, but you can see once the bonus got diluted away from just the revenue raised, then there was less of an impact. Interestingly, they did ex post surveys of customer satisfaction and found that it was the same across the three groups. So it wasn't that these tax inspectors behaved badly and sort of squeezed money out of people. So that, in fact, it turned out to be quite a powerful incentive. What they're doing now is to go on and to test other types of incentives. So in particular, they're testing different promotion incentives as opposed to financial incentives to see whether that's, you know, how those compare with the financial incentives. But what's been identified here is a strategy that you know, has been proven to work. Okay, well, what about the other side? But what about the government sort of delivering services? Well, this is an example from Zambia. And the government realized that it was really, the health system was really not reaching the vast majority of the population because the majority of the population is still living in rural areas and some of them quite remote from cities. So they decided to set up a new scheme called a community health worker scheme. And the idea was, instead of trying to send people from Lusaka or some big city and say, we want you to go out and man this clinic in this rural area, where they knew they would just want to come back, they said, okay, well, let's try to hire people from the community. And they recognized already that financial incentives were not likely to be the most powerful in terms of getting the right kind of person. So what they thought was what they would be best off using is what are called pro-social motivation. So they came up with this idea that we'll say something like, here's your chance to serve your community as a way to attract strong candidates. What the IDC researchers did was to say, okay, you know, we think that's a good thing to test, but if we're testing, let's test another strategy as well. So let's test a strategy which attracts people who want to build their skills. So they said, what about people who are more career-minded, maybe a bit more ambitious, want to build their skills? Let's try that as an alternative approach and see what happens. So these are actually the two posters that were used in these 48 rural communities, 24 for each, in the initial rollout of this program to recruit community health workers. And so 24 of them, people these leaflets were distributed, which appealed to people's community orientation, and in the other 24, it was appealing to their skills. And then what the researchers did was to test in several different phases. So they tested at the recruitment phase, when people were hired, what were their matric scores, their math scores, and basic sort of high school results. Then in the first year, they tested their performance. And then the 3 years down, they tested health outcomes in the area. So what did they find? Well, as a result of the appointments, they found that the people who were appointed under the skills strategy had higher math scores and generally higher sort of qualifications. They also found that that group had higher performance once in the job. So they did more visits to households And the visits weren't any shorter. They were sort of trying to cut short and move on. And they did more sort of outreach and sort of things. But the most striking thing was 3 years down the road, the health outcomes were better. So there was lower infant mortality and lower maternal mortality and so forth. And that's linked to the fact that they were getting more people to give birth in clinic and they were getting more sort of health messages out there and so forth. So the Ministry of Health then adopted this as their strategy for recruiting. Not only that, but now other ministries in Zambia have gotten interested in thinking more about their recruiting in terms of how to get the right people into the right job. So what I think is very important about this is that, as I said there, that good government's only possible with good people, and good government's essential to growth. So if you want to have growth, then you need to think about how you get good people. There's no universal answer. So government needs to be able to learn what way is going to work best. Okay, firm productivity is the second big driver of growth, and there are lots of important questions here. What drives productivity? How can we facilitate the reallocation of resources to more productive firms? And what about the role of FDI and trade for developing countries? Well, one thing we know about productivity is that in developing countries, and even in this case of India, of course, in the emerging market, there's much more dispersion in terms of being a lot more unproductive firms and just a bigger spread generally. So this is the U.S., and you can see there's a degree of variation there too, but much less than there is in India, and of course the situation's even more pronounced in low-income economies. So there's a lot of variation in productivity, a lot of unproductive firms. What else do we know? Well, we know that small is not beautiful, that small companies and informal companies tend to have much lower productivity. So this is comparing sort of traditional, so informal firms with modern firms, and you can see sharply different output per worker. Recent evidence from Africa, which compared firms that were 8 years old, so relatively new firms, those who had 50 or more employees from those that had 10 or less. Those that had 50 or more employees paid wages that were almost four times higher on average, almost four times higher than those that had 10 or fewer employees. So small firms, particularly small firms that don't succeed in growing, tend to be very low productivity firms. If we look at economies in Africa that have had successful growth trajectories, this is between 2000 and 2010, or 2009 in some cases, then we see one that, you know, we have a number of countries that have been really strong performers, but we also see that in every case, manufacturing has increased significantly. So manufacturing is the red bar. And you can see that in every one of these cases, there were significant increases in manufacturing. Work by another of our colleagues here in the department, John Sutton, has highlighted just how important manufacturing is as a driver of growth. And one of the first things he did was to look in five different countries, one of which was Ethiopia, at the 50 largest firms in the country and try to ascertain where they came from, what the origins of the firm was. And what came out of this was that the large manufacturing firms did not, for the most part, start life as small manufacturing firms. In fact, of the 50, only two started life as small manufacturing firms. So most small firms in Africa, like the Googles in the garage, don't get out of the garage. Most of them stay small. Where do these come from then, the manufacturing firms? Well, as you can see, the biggest single source was local traders. So what's special about local traders? Well, what's special about traders is that they have contact with buyers and sellers. And so what's happened in Ethiopia in the most pronounced way, but happened in the other African countries he studied as well, is that traders then vertically integrated, and that's how they became manufacturers. So they were supplying these international buyers and gradually began to establish production. And that's how they became manufacturers. So what's going on there? Well, If you look across African countries and across developing countries generally, there's a very common pattern in terms of what industries they have. They all have something like four or five basic industries. They have, you know, cement, they have food, basic food, beverage, beer, they have plastic, piping, and they have galvanized sheeting and drawn wire. So there's just a quite small number of things they all do. Those are all things that have high transport costs, low, you know, technology, so you don't get foreign competition, and you just serve the protected local market. What distinguishes the successful economies in Africa is that they have industries that face outward. And they face outward in either of two ways, either because they sell internationally, so exporting is one of the key drivers of productivity gains, or they sell to FDI investors who come in. So FDI investors, foreign direct investors who come into the economy, then where they establish a supply chain of local producers, that creates incentives for those producers who have to meet the quality standard of the foreign company to increase their productivity. In the process, then, they tend to develop export opportunities as well because they all of a sudden have a product which meets the demands of exporters. So two key things, and this is, you know, becoming an increasing focus, certainly in Ethiopia, but in many African countries. Two key things in terms of driving industrialization is connecting to international supply chains, either through foreign direct investors or through exporting. Let me give you one more example in firms, and that's agriculture. 65% of Africa's labor force is in agriculture, so agriculture is very important. And yet the sector counts for only 32% of GDP, so that tells you straight away that these people are stuck in activities that are less productive than average by a good margin. So the question is, why is this productivity so low? Why do agricultural yields in Africa fall so far short of the rest of the world? Is it that technology just hasn't arrived, that the Green Revolution sort of has passed Africa by? Well, it turns out not to be the case. So here's the yield. These are cereal yields. Blue is sub-Saharan Africa. So it's basically been flat for, 30 years? Whereas, you know, in South Asia and other regions, yields have been increasing steadily. Why has it happened? Well, it hasn't happened because the Green Revolution passed Africa by. It's happened because of a market failure. What is it? Well, this is samples of fertilizer that are taken from local markets across Uganda. And those fertilizer bags should have 50-something percent urea, because that's the active constituent of the fertilizer. This is that level, 56%. Not a single sample that they had reached that level. So the quality of the fertilizer that farmers are able to buy in the local market has been so badly cut with other stuff, or just not taken care of in transport or whatever, that what they're buying is much lower quality than what it should be. And the same is true of hybrid seeds. So fertilizers and seeds are the key inputs. This research project here looked at, did test farms, and they said, okay, if we have a farmer who has authentic fertilizer and hybrid seed, what return does she get on her investment in those? And this is taking out labor costs. She gets a return of 51%. Okay? So in Africa, it really is profitable to use hybrid seeds and fertilizer. What return does she get if she uses the fertilizer and seed that she finds in her local market? She loses 12.2%. So the quality of the stuff that she can buy in the local market is so bad that it's not economical for her to purchase. So what we have is a market problem here. And there's some subsequent research now that's looking at different sort of solutions to this. And you could think of very cheap indicators, might be one test. You know, if you could devise a cheap indicator for knowing whether the fertilizer you buy. But what the study we're funding is looking at whether combining the buyer of your output, your crop, with the supplier of your inputs into a single entity will solve the incentive problem and generate better results. Okay, let me keep going. I'm running a bit slower than I intended. So just about cities are the third area. And really in cities there are two big challenges for low-income countries. One is managing what are sometimes called the downsides of density. So I'm thinking about congestion, contagion, and crime. So congestion, disease, and crime. And also how you get the benefits of agglomeration. because we know the great thing about cities and the things that the reason cities are really growth hubs is that they collapse distance between people, between firms and people, and between firms. And all of that can dramatically increase efficiency by facilitating exchange of ideas, by reducing transaction costs, and so forth. So that's just a map that tells you how much African cities are going to be growing over the next couple of decades. So by 2045, the urban population of the world is expected to increase from 3.9 billion today to over 6 billion. 90% of that growth will come in developing countries. So almost all of the urbanization that's going to take place over the next three decades, is going to be in Africa and Asia. And so it's going to be a huge driver of what happens with growth. Cities, as I said, can be huge drivers of growth. Why? Well, because cities address the twin problem of scale and specialization. By bringing people together, they enable firms to achieve scale and the economies that come with scale. They also enable them to achieve a much higher level of specialization. So they're drawing on a much larger labor pool. The effect of both of those is such that when you double city size, you increase productivity by an estimated 5 to 7%. Now, if that doesn't seem like a big number to you, what it means is if you go from a city of 300,000 to a city of 5 million, you increase productivity by 30%. So that's a big number. So cities, and those are data from developed countries. So we know from developed countries that cities have the potential to be big drivers of growth. Cities in developing countries have faced a number of challenges. Principal among them is that the developing world is urbanizing at a much earlier stage than the now developed world did. So the level of per capita income is much lower across Africa and in South Asia during the period right now when they're advertising. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because cities are expensive and cities are difficult to make work. So cities are expensive because you need all this infrastructure. Right? You need expensive transport infrastructure, sanitation, sewerage, and water. You need housing, all sorts of things. You need energy infrastructure. So cities are expensive. And cities require strong governments, and that's the other place that developing countries struggle. Because cities are regulation intensive. Right? Think of all the things that need to be regulated in a city, from land use to water use to all the different utilities and so forth. So there's a real challenge for developing countries is how can they grow and be sort of hubs of growth with these challenges. Well, at a general level, one of the principal keys is how to enhance connectivity. So how can we drive down transport costs and how can we increase density to enable people to connect at lower cost? Well, just one quick example here. We're doing a number of studies of different bus rapid transit systems because those are really an economical way to expand the reach of a public transport system. And it's clear already that these transit systems can have important impacts on connecting people with jobs, so matching, on people's incentives to study and improve their skills, on health outcomes, and on incomes, labor market outcomes, and on incomes. So these investments can yield quite high returns in terms of growth. Okay, last thing I want to talk about is energy, and in particular energy access. And we focus on a number of things, including improving the grid reliability and reach of the grid, energy efficiency and sustainability, and all of those, of course, and how they contribute to access. Well, I don't know how well you can see this with these lights on, but this is, I'm sure you've seen something like this before. It's a map of the world at night. And I think what you see very clearly is just how dark most of the low-income countries are. And so that's really the challenge. One in three Africans have no access to electricity. Nearly a billion people worldwide don't have access to electricity. If you look at African firms, African manufacturing firms face power outages an average of 56 days a year. It's estimated it costs them 6% or more of sales. It's estimated that in Pakistan and Nigeria, for example, power outages reduce GDP growth by 2% a year. So there's a huge drain on these economies from the lack of access to reliable power. Now, much of the policy response has been about increasing generation. So, gee, we need more power, so we need to build power plants. What do we do? Do we do coal? Do we do renewables? Whatever. But one of the fundamental issues is these countries lack the revenue base in order to fund this power. So I just want to give you this last example, which is a study in Bihar on electricity access. And in particular, it's something that's highly relevant to a number of low-income country situations where electricity is supplied to communities but not to individual households directly, in the sense that it's not billed at the household level, it's billed at the community level. So what that means is instead of knowing what your own household consumption is, you have a fixed payment that you're expected to make, and you get, you know, some share of the electricity. Well, this tells you sort of what goes wrong in that kind of situation. So this is the revenue rate, that is, what percentage of households are paying for electricity in that particular community, from 0 up to 100%. And the vertical axis says how much electricity are they being supplied with. Well, if we had a well-functioning market, then this line should be like this, right? So if you don't pay, you don't get any electricity. If you pay, you get 24 hours a day of electricity. But instead, what we see is this sort of scatter, which has a barely upward-sloping line, right? But very little correlation between supply and payment. So fundamentally, the market's not working here. Well, it's not easy to make a market work if you can't withhold supply of a good if someone doesn't pay for it, right? That's fundamentally what we talk about in economics, is the property right that enables you to withhold supply if someone doesn't pay for a good. But if you have community supply, that is, supply, electricity is being supplied to 5,000 households at once, how do you do this? Well, what our researchers are doing is to say, let's see if we can nudge people into paying more. So what they've done in this group, and it's working with the Ministry of Energy, is to send out notices with all the bills that say, if you increase, as a community, you increase your payment rate by 10 percentage points, you will get 2 more hours of electricity a day. So, you know, and here's the scale. So if they get it up to 40%, they'll get 18 hours of electricity a day. If it stays less than 10%, they'll only get 10 hours of electricity a day. Now, it's still in the field, so we don't know the results yet. But from an early exercise they did, which had to do with just changing load shedding, that's sort of who you cut off, it looks like there's quite a big response. You know, up to twice the revenue can be generated if you're doing this appropriately. So we're still waiting for the results, but we're sort of cautiously optimistic that this actually is going to make a big difference in terms of generating more revenue, which then enables the government to create more generation. Okay, let me finish there, and just going back to the beginning to say, what are these new approaches? Well, I think the new approaches are at three different levels. One is at the country level, recognizing that, one, there are no magic solutions, and two, there are no imported solutions that work. So we need to work with countries to develop their own solutions. Researchers need to work in country and with policymakers to contribute to that process, but also we need to recognize that there's no silver bullet, that lots of things are going to have to contribute together to an effective growth strategy. At the level of taking a step back from that, I think the level of what we can contribute as researchers to this process, I think there's a recognition that we have a better set of tools now than we used to, and that's made this dialogue with policymakers much more productive and much more useful than it used to be. And I think one of the keys to that is thinking about collaboration as part of the research process, not as something that comes afterwards. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jonathan. I definitely enjoyed it. So I'd like to open up the floor now for some questions. So if you just raise your hands, you know, like, then we'll make it that the Microphone gets to you. Okay, so I guess you know that we got the one there.
Okay, let me repeat the question because the microphone wasn't working. So the question was, often data in developing countries is unreliable. So how do we respond to that? How do we deal with that? Well, a couple of ways. One is many of these studies I was talking about were experimental studies which generate their own data. So in that case, there's the researcher is generating her own data. It solves the problem. Quite a bit of the work, however, that we do does use administrative data from government. And it's surprising how often that is reasonably robust, that many countries did set up reasonably robust systems for collecting information on taxpayers and their tax payments and so forth. So there's more data than you might think. Where data is very weak is on firms. So firm surveys are very weak, and that's something we've been pushing with DFID, which is the UK aid agency, is to try to convince them to invest more in firm data. So I think there are areas like that where improvement is needed. But there is, between the possibilities that there are to create your own data and the data that's there, there's a lot to go on. So it's not a major obstacle now, even though it's an important issue. A really good question. I think increasingly there is evidence that trade-off isn't quite as severe as we used to think it was, in that that there are a lot of sort of sustainable strategies which turn out to be also sort of low cost, environmentally sustainable strategies which turn out to be lower cost strategies in the long run. So there isn't quite the trade-off, I think, that there once was, and there are people. We don't do a lot of research in this area, but we do some research, and one of the things that we've been doing is trying to figure out how governments can be most effective in regulating firms. So we've done a study in India about pollution regulation, and the system, this was in, I think it was in Gujarat, the system was such, and this is actually quite common in the developed world, that firms appointed their own auditors. In terms of whether they were complying with pollution. And so the first step here was to have some outside auditors just see if they agreed with the firm appointed auditors, and surprisingly they didn't. They found they were quite different. So they convinced the government to change regulation, to require the auditors to be externally appointed. And there was a dramatic effect on pollution, because what you found when they were internally appointed was there's a whole bunch of firms bunched just below the limit, that their pollution emissions were just below the legal limit, whereas of course many of them in practice were breaching the limit. So that was something that's now resulted in a change in policy. So I think there are smart things that can be done. That reduced, increased the effectiveness of regulation, reduced the cost of regulation, and then also helped to sort of drive these, the sort of sustainable choices. That said, there will be some trade-offs, and energy is an area that's where it is difficult, because solar is coming down quite dramatically in cost, but coal is still pretty cheap. And in cash terms, particularly, it's still pretty cheap. So there is some, in some countries, there are some difficult choices. And I think once you start pricing coal socially, you know, and taking coal into impact, then of course you get numbers which are you know, not competitive. But for governments that are, you know, very cash constrained and so forth, then there can be difficult choices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Nonik, yeah, I see Nonik there at the back, yeah.
It's a good question. It's a good challenge. It's a big challenge facing countries. This isn't the best example, but it's just such a striking example that I want to share it. I recently heard that something like 80% of the educated population of Syria now lives outside Syria, and some big number, I forget what it is, lives in Germany now. Some, I forget, it's like 20 or 30% of the educated Syrians worldwide live in Germany. Now, that's a dramatic situation, of course, because of the high level of conflict, but it is a big issue. I think there is a kind of virtuous circle between taking growth seriously and keeping talented people, because part of keeping growth seriously, I mean, part of what drives growth, a big part of what drives growth is the sort of accumulation of ideas. You know, so it's innovation, whether it's managerial or technological or other sorts of innovation. And if you're orienting policy to create more opportunities for that, you're more likely to keep, you know, talented people. So I think there are some important sort of positive feedback loops there. I think, you know, where we have the more dramatic situations, so failed states or fragile states or whatever, I think, you know, we do need, as sort of internationally in terms of the role of aid and overseas, to think about what's the right way to manage the policies. So, you know, should we, to avoid over-incentivizing people to leave, you know, to flee. So can we provide support in a way that, you know, strengthens the incentives to stay? So it's clearly a challenge, but I think, you know, it's one that can be addressed as part of the sort of growth policy thing, because there's a lot of good feedback there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess now maybe Nonik, yeah, I think those two people down there, you know, like lifted their hands up. No, like maybe both of you, no, all three of you can ask your question, and then Jonathan will take them in turn.
How's the growth from developing countries, increased growth there, going to affect developed countries? Your question is how is, sorry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, yeah, how growth in developed countries affect developing countries.
Well, we take three questions and I'll come, I'll mm-hmm. answer all together.
Okay, and the next one down there.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, let me start. I'll take them in order, I guess. So the first question was about how will increased growth in developing countries affect developed countries. I'm not sure there's very much to say about that, in the sense that, you know, growth, whether demand and supply coming out of developing country is coming out of developing countries as opposed to another developed country, I think doesn't have a huge huge influence. The there are two sort of economic and political interactions that may be important. One is, it's quite clear now that, particularly with slowing population growth in the developed countries, that we're going to see lower rates of growth in many developed economies, and probably in China as well, with the falling population. And so developing countries are likely, at least some of them, to become more important in terms of driving the growth of the world economy. So I think there may be some positive effects from developing countries who are succeeding in achieving higher rates of growth in actually having a positive effect then on some of the developed countries as they grow. On the political instability question, it's a very big challenge. We're starting to do more work on fragile states. We are already in 8 countries which are classified as having varying degrees of stability. We had a program in South Sudan. Well, we still have a program in South Sudan, but we had to pull someone out about 2 weeks ago when the violence got worse. And it is very hard in that kind of situation to be formulating any kind of policies because the instability is too pronounced. But I think we are getting a better understanding of how to build stability. So just to give you one example, and I'm not claiming this is an answer, but one example of the kind of analysis which I think is helping a bit, is that economists, as I'm sure you know, have over the past 10 years or so focused more on institutions and the role of building institutions as part of a sort of effective state and then platform for an effective economy. But there's increasingly now, very recently, more attention on how you make institutions work. So not just do you have the right architecture of institutions, but how do you generate the culture and the norms within institutions that then make them effective? Because often, if you look at some of the more unstable countries, they seem to have all the right things, right? They have a tax office and whatever, but they aren't working, right? And so the question is, how do you build the sort of the culture and so forth that makes them work? And I think there are various interesting sort of bits of that piece that are beginning to, that challenge that are beginning to come together. One is thinking a lot more about identity and what shapes identity and its relationship between the relationships between the structure of identities in a country and the structure of authority or power in a country. And typically in a fragile state, identities are local. And that makes it very hard for authority to be national because it doesn't have a base. There's not a national identity. So developed countries all have established national identities, and that provides a basis, a foundation on which national authority can be built. If identity is all spread locally, so if it's spatially dispersed identity, then it's harder to establish a national authority. So, you know, one of the things Paul Collier, who's one of our sort of directors of the IGC, has argued is that pushing for national elections is not necessarily a good idea because, you know, artificially creating a national authority, which does not have a basis in sort of identities, is unlikely to be successful. So I think there's still a lot of challenges, but I think we're beginning to understand a bit better what actions can make a difference. In terms of the challenges of low-skilled workers, I guess the only thing, I don't have very much to say about that. I think the only thing I would say is that it is important to think about skill development as sort of endogenous in the sense that if an economy is starting to grow, then people have a stronger incentive to acquire skills, and that's a key driver. So rather than the solution being we've got to educate everybody, which is hard to get right if people don't have a demand, right? There's not a job they're going to go into, whatever. Then I think focusing on growth, recognizing that, of course, universal schooling is important and so forth, but is probably the better way to go. So I'll give you the most, so the example where there's really hard evidence, and that is training people to be business people is just a bad idea. It's just really hard to show any impact whatsoever from the kind of standard, here's how you set up a business course. That what you need to do is to have people generate economic activity, so create opportunities for people to start their business, and then allow their own incentives to acquire skills as they become relevant to drive what they do, rather than trying to push the cart, you know, before the horse by saying, no, no, here's all the skills you'll need, then go off and do a business. Because it just turns out, although it seems logical that that would work, it just turns out not to work, that the empirical evidence is really hard to find empirical evidence that that kind of basic business training has any impact.
Okay, some more questions? Okay, all right, so we got two there. You know, like, maybe you can take those two questions. So you need to speak out loud. Okay. And you?
My question relates to the energy study and reliability of energy from what my knowledge is as well as with friends that have worked in Africa, African countries. Would this study also cover the people reliability issue, while there may be incentives for people to pay because of one or the other, would the lack of reliability
Okay. Sure. Are you saying does the lack of reliability discourage foreign investors in particular? Okay. Okay. That PPPs could work or something. Okay. Should we take one more? Is there one more? Yeah, two. Okay. On the sort of problem, the challenges of sort of urbanization, and should you go for a sort of dispersed group of cities versus a few big cities? There are some trade-offs involved, obviously, because when you think about the kind of benefits of, in productivity terms, of increasing size, then if you spread yourself too thinly, you're not going to get the benefits of the full benefits of urbanization. On the other hand, there does seem to be some evidence that if the sort of primate city, the single largest city, gets too large, that is also bad in terms of development trajectories. So I think there's a lot of thought now being given to the role of what are called secondary cities. So typically, the ones that aren't the capital. So you have you would have a big capital city, and then you have secondary cities. And I think that a lot of attention now is being paid to try to encourage those secondary cities to develop, but not to sort of spread thinly sort of across the country. And then there also are big challenges in terms of how you manage the very large cities, because a lot of low-income economies have very large cities, and that raises a set of challenges as well. On energy, yes, I mean, as you were saying, lack of reliability does, of course, discourage investors, not only foreign but domestic investors as well. PPPs, those are public-private partnerships. They don't have a great track record in Africa, and I think part of the problem is that they're quite demanding to get to work properly. So we have been engaging a little bit with Ethiopia on in terms of infrastructure development and how best to finance that. And I think it looks like they need somehow to get a critical mass of expertise to then be able to manage a process of procurement from private suppliers. And so that can come just as, you know, as they get bigger and, you know, and there's more projects they want to manage. It could be that there's some scope for regionalizing that kind of capacity. So getting, you know, the East African community is quite effective now. And so it may be that there's some ways to get that capacity in a way that can make PPPs more successful. But the PPPs too often in developing countries, especially in Africa, have been the product of the supplier coming to the government and saying, here's what we'll do. And then, you know, it may not be that they're fleecing them completely, but it doesn't end up with the right outcome for the government, because the government should be setting its strategy and then what it wants to procure from private sector providers, and, you know, and to try to get, of course, the best, you know, the best outcomes in terms of price and what, you know, and benefits. So I think PPPs are a challenging area for low-income countries, and, you know, there still isn't a sort of good solution. It, just as another example, USAID has had a major initiative called Power Africa, and it really hasn't been very successful. And the reason is just that it's proven very difficult to get private. It was aimed at trying to get more private investment in here, and it's very difficult to do that unless you have a really quite sophisticated sort of capacity in government to manage the process from the public sector side. The example of the Philippines and my example of Bihar in India, yes, there are lots of examples of non-inclusive growth. And I think, you know, we are learning, you know, more about how you can build growth that will be more inclusive. You know, Bihar was a good example because politically the party that was driving this reform was the party that appealed to the lower castes there, and so they had a very strong constituency that they were that it was a key focus of the chief minister. It's again, I think, the situation that I sort of mentioned overall for growth, that there's no single policy that does it, that it really has to sort of permeate most areas of policy. So whether that's access to electricity, thinking about how can you create access for people whose use is so low that it's not efficient for them to have a meter, right? So you have to correct that problem. Then, you know, you say, okay, how do we deliver water supply to that household if they can't pay for their connection? So, is it efficient for the government to subsidize that connection or not? Anyway, so there's lots of little questions that you have to think about, and then figure out where the returns are going to be greatest, because government can't do everything, and then sort of build up a policy in that way. Maybe just taking a step back, another part of the answer is how do we create incentives for governments to take that kind of approach, you know, in terms of take a more inclusive approach to growth. I think that's raises another set of questions, but there I think things like accountability and transparency and stuff seem to be, you know, quite important.
Okay, there's still some more questions. Okay, I guess we're going to go for the three that we have there on the right hand side, so why don't you start there first, yeah? The lady in front of you.
Yeah, my question was a bit specific because you could draw the same conclusion from the question that in India living for a day and then just forget about it.
Okay, and then this gentleman. Yep.
In the beginning of this, your lecture, you showed us that state capacity matters for economic growth, and you also showed us that democracy is much more effective than autocracy. Is it possible that the failure of autocracy is that because of its lack of capacity, or is there any similarity between democracy and state?
Okay. Okay. But a really good question. Let me take that first and then I'll work back to the other two. I didn't mean to argue that democracy is always superior to autocracy in growth, because of course, you know, we can think of examples that go both directions. What does seem very clear, however, is that autocracy generates much higher variance in terms of economic outcomes. So if you have a capable, benevolent leader, then you can get very strong positive outcomes. But you have a much bigger low tail under autocratic systems. So many more sort of situations of economic collapse. So the probability of economic crisis and collapse is much higher under autocracy than it is under democracy. So democracy has basically a much sort of more concentration around sort of lower levels of growth, with a smaller upper tail, but a much, much smaller lower tail. In terms of is the failure of autocracy linked to limited capacity? I think there's variation between different models, because we can both think of models of autocracies that have had a high level of capacity, and those where there hasn't been. So, and equally with democracies, we can think of a lot of examples of democracies which have very limited capacity. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not aware of any kind of useful regularity there on that score. So I think the one interesting thing that's come out, it's again a colleague of ours, Tim Besley, who's been working on this recently, is this seems quite robust thing that the autocracies are just much more, have much higher variance in terms of outcomes, whereas democracy is more restricted. Okay, on the use of happiness, it's interesting you raised that question. I was meeting with Richard Layard, it's a colleague of ours who's worked a lot on happiness and well-being, as you probably know, and written books, a number of books on it, and we may well be cooperating with them in a new project. Poverty is bad for happiness. It's not clear all the mechanisms, but people in poverty seem to have higher levels of cortisol, sort of stress-related hormones, and there's been interesting behavioral research that talks about how poverty also sort of decreases, obviously, it generates cognitive impairment, and in particular tends to create this sort of laser focus on sort of making it to the next whatever, the next meal, the next day, whatever, and in a way that then makes people behave in very unproductive ways. I think that's an interesting aspect of a poverty trap. Is that the cognitive effects of poverty make you more likely to be stuck there? So I think there are really important issues here. Our short-term ambition, which probably won't sound very ambitious, is to try to get more researchers just to build in two or three or four standard questions that are pretty robust indicators now. So the OECD has endorsed this handful of small number of questions, so that even if they're not interested in looking at it, that we have more, we can build over time some better household data on these issues and understand better. So it's a good thing, very good point. On inequality, I'm not sure I 100% understood your question, but I think you're talking about basically how do you create incentives for people to help themselves and to invest more in their education. Is that right? It's a great question. I think partly, okay, this may seem a little bit unrelated, but I think it's related, that I think people don't expect governments to change their situation overnight. But as a South African political scientist said in the years after the end of apartheid, he said, what's really important is that they see the queue moving. Right? So even if I don't have a house today, I see the queue moving, so I know that eventually I'll get a house or, you know, or whatever. Now, what is that saying? Well, I think what that's saying is that, you know, the process has to be transparent and has to be fair, right? And so people see that there. And sort of linking back, trying to link back a little bit more directly to your question, I think what that says is that, you know, you can create incentives for people to invest in their own skills and so forth. If they can, if you enable them to, if you convince them that they will have greater economic opportunities in the future than they have now. And so it's worth investing to take advantage of those. So how do you do that? Well, I think, again, by being transparent and systematic so that people see that, yes, the government is investing in water or schools or electricity or whatever it is. And, you know, my turn will come. You know, opportunities will come my way, and I will get, you know, more out of them if I begin to invest in myself. So I think that, you know, something like that seems to me an important part of the solution.
Okay, well, I guess, Nonek, we've come to the end, Nonek, and I think Jonathan have been answering lots of very interesting questions. We can definitely continue some of these questions in the reception in the senior common room, but I would like to thank Nonek, Jonathan, Nonek, for Nonek's lovely...
And I was thinking, oh, gee, what if the people with international relations, what are they going to get out of this? And
no, the thing is, you know, like, it is available to everybody, but by and large, you know, like last week there was another public seminar, but I didn't even get the message, you know, like, or the economic lectures and classes, I didn't even get that message to sort of like promote it. But for yours, all the economic lectures, you know, like, and class teachers received it, which idea if you think that it is your student.